Robert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mueller, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. Today, a fascinating conversation with one of America's leading Christian intellectuals, Alvin Plantinga, professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He is a guest here in the studio. He's here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary presenting the Norton Lectures, and we're going to be talking about the Christian mind in the 21st century. We're going to be talking about what you should be thinking about as your kids, or perhaps as you yourself, are encountering the university culture and the exchange of ideas, the clash of worldviews in modern America. That coming up in just a moment. To get ready to join the conversation with Dr. Alvin Plantinga, call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some issues in the news, the big news nationwide in terms of what is most urgent certainly has to be the evacuation of now over a quarter of a million persons in California as fires are spreading. According to the latest reports, it looks like these wildfires are burning in at least 15 separate burns in seven counties. And, of course, all of this is being fed by gale-force winds, which are both fueling the fires in their intensity and spreading the fires, starting new ones. It's being described by fire authorities in California as a great natural disaster. It's being called a hydra, as this many-headed monster appears to be threatening much of Southern California. Very, very famous fires right now you've probably seen on your television screens around San Diego and, of course, in Malibu. I was watching the television just briefly, but I saw the ruins of the Malibu Presbyterian Church. It's a reminder to us that this is a very real and present danger for an awful lot of Americans. And it is also a reminder to us all of how close natural disaster is. And we need to be praying for the people of Southern California, especially for the preservation of human life. And just imagine all the heartache and all the concern as many people right now are looking at the smoldering ruins of what they had known as home. And many others are looking at their homes wondering if they soon will be smoldering ruins. We'll be tracking this story with you. And, of course, the national media are giving this a great deal of attention. At my website, albertmueller.com, overnight, I posted a major article entitled, "A Fine French Art America Cannot Afford," asking the question, does marriage really matter anymore? What is the fine French art? Well, according to the editors of the Los Angeles Times, this fine French art is separating personal morality from politics. In particular, in an editorial entitled, "A Divorce," the editors of the Los Angeles Times suggest that Americans should simply get with it, get with the program, and learn from the French that a political candidate or office holder's marriage has nothing to do with his or her stewardship of public trust and public office. The background to this is, of course, the very messy divorce in France of the French president Nicolas Sarkozy and his now ex-wife, which is his second wife. And this is really a very interesting story because French politics is so different, as French culture is so different than American culture on this score. And, of course, you're looking at the inheritance of the French Enlightenment, the anti-clericalism. You're looking at a much more secularized society. If you go two French presidents back to François Mitterrand, you're talking about a man who was himself very openly an atheist, a man who, well, let's just look to his funeral. At his funeral, provision was made for his mistress and the daughter he had by his mistress in terms of the public funeral, something very different than what you would see in America. Now Nicolas Sarkozy has divorced his wife. Interesting little footnote that in that, by the way. She could not divorce the president because the French president has legal immunity, even from his wife, for divorce. But he can divorce her, and that's what took place. And, of course, you have many in the American media saying, look, look how civilized France is. The divorce took 15 minutes. It was over. It's not considered a major issue. It's certainly not a political crisis for President Sarkozy. But in the United States, it would be a political crisis. Well, just about any reflection, I think, will bring to mind imagining an American president under similar circumstances is rather difficult to do. But what the Los Angeles Times editors are now calling for is for Americans to grow up and join the French. They're calling this a fine French art. They're calling it a matter of French tolerance, of understanding that marriage has nothing essentially to do with personal character and with public conduct in office. I'm going to suggest that that's a fine French art we can do without. Indeed, we must do without. Because even though we do have to grow up and understand that our own political history involves political leaders who did have credibility and did provide public leadership, who we now know not models of marital rectitude, we also understand that it's quite different just to say at the front of the political process, this doesn't matter. How can it not matter? How can an individual's most public and personal commitments not point to how they would fulfill their public commitments as well? If a candidate cannot be trusted to honor his marital commitments and marital vows, how can we believe that all of a sudden there would be greater fealty given to an oath of office? It's not exactly the same thing. And evangelical voters, of course, looking at the options in the 2008 race, are confronted with the reality that politics is, as is so often described, the art of the possible. But the last thing we need to do is to abdicate marriage as an issue that is related to personal character. That would be disastrous for marriage. It would also be disastrous, I think, for our political culture. In this case, the last thing we need to do is to follow the French example. Looking at generational change in America, USA Today is pointing to how the new generation is redefining privacy. They're redefining it by basically throwing it away. They're throwing it away not only on the World Wide Web, but in particular through their websites, Facebook, MySpace, and all the rest. This story quotes Indigo Rael, age 22, of Lake Dallas, Texas, who says, "I am constantly broadcasting who I am. The Internet is just a way for me to reach more people with who I am. It's the age of information. I'm used to giving and receiving tons." Well, if you have anything to do with young people in America today, especially high school and college age, you know that they are living on the web. It's almost as if the second life is becoming their life. And they're broadcasting their lives in a way that is not the case and was not the case with any previous generation. We know things about them that we frankly don't need to know. But I wonder how many of them recognize that in documenting their lives, they're doing just that. They are documenting their lives, the mundane and the important, what might be described as the good, the bad, and the ugly. Now, quoting from the article, which is by Janet Kornblum, was one of the most interesting writers at USA Today. She writes, "In the old days of their parents' and grandparents' generations, when teens wanted to talk to each other, they'd pick up the phone. Sometimes they'd have to resort to actual face-to-face conversations. Today's teens and adults in their 20s are a lot more likely to reach for a computer keyboard to convey something as fleeting as a mood or as traumatic as a breakup, even if it's only to a list of trusted friends. They are growing up in an environment, in a culture where you get constant feedback from others in ways that we never did," says psychologist Linda Young, who teaches at Seattle University and writes about teens and technology. You know, I was talking just the other day about how college students are using instant messaging. They're using instant messaging rather than actually talking to each other on the phone. They have cell phones, but their cell phones really aren't operating as phones anymore. They're instant messaging devices. And you're getting bundled packages from major providers of upwards of 1,500 instant messages available in this package for students per month. It's hard for me to imagine that they're getting any studying done, that they're doing anything other than giving and receiving these instant messages. But it is interesting to note that this is a generation. Bill Gates calls them Generation E, the electronic generation that knows nothing else. Looking at the older generation, the Wall Street Journal is looking to the way baby boomers are putting their own spin on the end of life. It turns out that as baby boomers are considering their own end, well, they're not comfortable with some of the burial and funeral practices of the past. Many of these practices of the parents, the ones we think of as normal for funerals, are going away. Instead, they're wanting themed funerals, cowboy style, Star Wars style, 21st century technological style in terms of funerals. Some funeral directors are deciding this is a new avenue for marketing. It also has to do with the fact that in 1980, cremations accounted for less than 10% of American deaths. Now they're up to a third, and the Cremation Association of North America expects them to pass by 50%. One specialist observed that attitudes toward death change as belief in the afterlife fades. Goodbye isn't quite the same when the departed is headed for a hole or a furnace and assumed to be no place else. Sociologist Tony Walter suggests that squinting at death is fun when, as now, death isn't staring unblinkingly back at you. In a global war or pandemic, the topic may not seem so amusing. For their part, boomers want a final Woodstockian opportunity to jolt the culture. Even though much of their original audience, the easily scandalized older generation, is getting its groove on elsewhere. You know, anthropologists point out that one of the most enduring witnesses of a civilization is their burial practices. And you recognize that the way one looks at death really is an indicator of the way one looks at life and ultimate reality. It's another sign to us that as Christianity recedes in the worldview of many people, death becomes something altogether different. If there's nothing on the other side, why not have a themed funeral and a party and just end it all with a cremation? Back to talk with Dr. Alvin Plantinga of the University of Notre Dame on the role of the Christian intellectual and the Christian mind in the 21st century. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. There is something of a renaissance in terms of the Christian intellectual tradition going on right now. And when people look across American or even international academic life looking for prominent Christian intellectuals, one of the persons to whom they often turn is Professor Alvin Plantinga. He is the John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. And it is a great honor for Southern Seminary to have him here delivering the Norton Lectures, which is a lectureship on philosophy and Christianity here at Southern Seminary. With us also in the studio is Dr. Russell Moore, guest host of this program, and Dean and Senior Vice President here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dr. Plantinga, it is indeed an honor for us to have you here. Your writings are some of the most cited, not only in the world of Christian discourse, but also in the world of philosophy. Now, you have been cited so often as one to whom we look as an example of Christian penetration of the academic world. Why is it happening in philosophy more than in some other subject areas?
I don't know. I've been asked that question before, and I don't know if I really know the answer. One part of the answer is that philosophers are very used to disagreeing with each other and arguing. As everybody knows, philosophers argue all the time. So there is sort of in physics, for example, and in psychology and some other subjects, conformity, saying the same thing as everybody else, is more important than it is in philosophy. In philosophy, you have a little more leeway to make a fool out of yourself or say something worthwhile. And that's part of it. Another part of it is that it just got started earlier on in philosophy. It got started like 40 years ago, a kind of renaissance in Christian philosophy, more interest in it. Why exactly it happened then is hard to say. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. The major study in American university life in terms of politics and worldview came out just a couple of weeks ago. One of the things that appears to be very interesting is that the more you get into the humanities, the more secularized the academic and intellectual environment tends to become.
I think that's in general true, with a possible exception, say, of biology. Biology is very secularized, though not in the humanities. And in the humanities, philosophy also is, at least in America, less secularized than say, some of the sciences or some of the other disciplines in the humanities.
When you have been teaching now for a few generations at the University of Notre Dame, I mean generations of students, that is, about every four
years.
I'm
not that old, right?
Yes, let me clarify that, because I've been here 15 years, and that's several generations of students, too. You're talking about, about a 4 or 5 year turnover of the student body. What do you really see in terms of the changing of the American student population?
It's a little hard to tell from Notre Dame. It's a special population, first. And second, I don't teach undergraduates. For the most part, I teach graduate students. With the graduate students, what I see at Notre Dame is students who are increasingly sharper, better prepared, better philosophers on the one hand, students who are, as compared with the students I knew when I was a graduate student myself, I and my graduate school confreres, who are much more concerned with each other's welfare, less competitive, I would say living out the law of love to a much greater extent than we ever did, and students who show a really powerful loyalty to the gospel. Students are really serious Christians and aim to make the advancement of Christianity or being Christian philosophers. They take that very seriously.
Now, you are a philosopher. You are yourself, in terms of tradition, from the Reformed tradition. You're teaching at the University of Notre Dame, which is perhaps identified more than any other institution with Roman Catholicism. Is this a place where there is a great deal, in the field of philosophy, a great deal of interaction between evangelical Christians, Protestants, and Roman Catholic thinkers?
There is there's a fair amount of that. There may be a little less than you might expect. First of all, Notre Dame is by no means monolithically Catholic. There are Jews on the faculty, atheists, Christians of various kinds, Protestants, Catholic, and the like, and various stripes of Catholic. So it's not at all a monolithic place. There is a certain amount of working back and forth between serious Protestant Christians and serious Catholic Christians there, but not as much as you might expect. I'm not sure exactly why, but there's a serious sort of traditional difference in tradition between Catholics and Protestants. And although Protestants are welcome at Notre Dame, I mean, I'm there and several others in the philosophy department, really serious Protestants, there still is this distinction. So there isn't any discomfort, but it's sort of a, how can I put this? You can tell there's a difference, right?
Well, that's very interesting. It's one of the thoughts I think a lot of people would have looking at this. But Notre Dame has certainly established a reputation in the field of graduate philosophical studies.
It's a very good school for Christian grad students in philosophy. It's, I would say, clearly the best place in the world. And my guess is some two-thirds of our graduate students in philosophy are, in fact, evangelicals or Protestants of one kind or another.
Let me ask you to turn again to the larger question. Let's just talk about the Christian intellectual responsibility, something about which you've written. You've encouraged groups ranging from Campus Crusade for Christ who have used your materials all the way to the elite academy. What do you think is the Christian intellectual responsibility? That's a good question for evangelicals to think about.
The Christian intellectual responsibility, it's kind of a difficult question. The part that I've thought about most, perhaps, and have talked about, is the responsibility of Christian intellectuals to the Christian community. So if you're a philosopher, you go to graduate school, same as in any other discipline, the same there as in philosophy, and you find yourself sort of drawn into that particular milieu. I mean, it's a certain sociological group. You think of yourself as a philosopher, and you adopt your standards from this group, and you tend to find your self-worth in how well you perform in this group. It's been my idea, and I mean, I think this is a totally obvious idea, but it's not one that's so easy to put into practice. The idea really is that that your first loyalty isn't to the American Philosophical Association or the American Psychological Association if you're a psychologist. Your first loyalty is really to the Christian Church and, of course, ultimately to God. I mean, that's whom you're aiming to serve. And that makes a real difference in what you do, the sorts of the sorts of questions you are interested in, the way in which you approach them, where you look for sort of reinforcement and the like. I think that's an important thing to think about for Christian academics and Christian intellectuals generally.
Do you see signs that a younger generation of evangelicals is taking up that responsibility?
Again, I can speak most clearly or most definitively or most reasonably on philosophy. I don't know that much. I don't know that much about the rest of the university world. But in philosophy, there is absolutely no doubt of this. There are now hundreds of young Christian philosophers around the country who are thinking seriously about these matters. They write for the whole Christian community as well, of course, as for the philosophical community. And I find this whole thing really heartening.
Dr. Russell Moore, we spend a good deal of time on college and university campuses. I know I'm seeing this in other fields as well.
That's exactly right. You have evangelicals in every field of study and taking it very seriously, taking these thoughts captive for Christ.
And when you start getting these evangelical students together, you notice that the intellectual conversation is something different than it was even 10 or 15 years ago. And I think it's of necessity because these young people are having to deal with worldview questions every single moment of their lives. It's not like that's a compartmentalized hobby they can be into. It's the sum and substance of how they have to think day by day. To join the conversation with Dr. Alvin Plantinga, give us a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. I know a lot of folks out there are avid readers of the works of Dr. Alvin Plantinga. He is, of course, the John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, one of the best-known Christian intellectuals of our day. If you have a question, a comment you want to pose to Professor Plantinga, just call us at 877-893-TALK. That's 877-893-8255. Now, there are many interesting things having to do with the writings of Dr. Plantinga. As an undergraduate majoring in religion and minoring in philosophy, I cut my teeth on a lot of his work having to do with issues from warrant, how one has a justified basis for holding to a belief, to what he has really done as kind of a revolution in apologetics by pointing to what he calls properly basic beliefs, what many other people would refer to as presuppositions. But I think one of the things that makes Dr. Plantinga rather special in the academy is that he can also write for a popular audience. And one of the most interesting things he has written of late is a review of Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. To put it simply, Dr. Plantinga didn't think much of it. Professor, how did this review come about?
Well, I was just asked to review this book. I first ran across Dawkins's work maybe 20 years ago with his book, The Blind Watchmaker. When I read it, I found the book utterly fascinating and also thoroughly irritating. I disagreed with practically everything Dawkins said in the book. And then later on, I was asked to review this most recent book of his, The God Delusion, which from the point of view of, I mean, the book is really not biology. Dawkins is a biologist, but the book is not biology. It's basically philosophy and theology and sort of social criticism. The philosophy in it is extraordinarily sophomoric, and that would be an insult to sophomores.
That's my favorite line. I was just about to read that back to you. But yes, in his review, he says you might say that some of his forays into philosophy are at best sophomoric, but that would be unfair to sophomores. In other words, you're accusing him of writing outside his field of expertise.
He's completely outside his field of expertise. But I don't blame someone for that. In this area of religion and science, practically everybody writes outside their area of expertise.
But they ought to at least know it.
Yeah, they ought to notice it. I mean, there are these at least three areas that come together here. There's philosophy, and then philosophy of science, especially in philosophy. Then there is also theology, and then there's a science in question. And hardly anybody nowadays is prepared really to be thoroughly competent in all these three. What we really have to do is find some young people, let's say age 10. They got some really bright young Christian people and train them, you know, get them to a PhD level in all three of these areas. And then let them go at it. Then we might really get somewhere.
That sounds like a good strategy. But we as evangelicals don't tend to think ahead that way as we're looking at our 10-year-olds. And frankly, it's hard to look at most 10-year-olds and quite come up with that. But I agree with you. That would be a great thing for the kingdom. In your review, and one of the things I most appreciate about it, is you get to the basic worldview issue at stake here. And you point out that the problem with Dawkins isn't just his sophomoric approach to philosophy. It's his basic commitment to naturalism. Explain that.
Well, Dawkins starts off by being a naturalist, where a naturalist is someone who thinks there is no such person as God or anything at all like God. And his aim in this book is, his aim in his previous book, where he was still arguing in a sensible way for his view, his aim was to show that the facts of evolution, or the evidence of evolution, as he calls it, shows that the world is without design. In this most recent book, it's really sort of a screed. He sounds like he's just absolutely either furious or really worried, really shaken. I mean, there isn't any sort of restraint or there's no sort of academic courtesy or anything of the kind. It's just sort of one set of insults after another.
What do you think explains this kind of revived militancy among atheists?
I don't know. It certainly is there. I mean, there's his book, and then there's Dennett's book, that book by Hitchens, two books by Sam Harris. I don't know exactly why that is, but I think it's partly because Christianity is more sort of, it's more evident. It's more there on the radar screen now.
Are these books being taken seriously in philosophy graduate departments?
Oh, no, not at all. There's nothing to them along those lines, whatever.
The whole show was worth that right there. Just to make very clear that even as these books and their authors are getting a great deal of attention in the media, they're not getting much attention where the real intellectual conversation is taking place about the very ideas they're seeking to write about. Give us a call at 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with Dr. Alvin Plantinga and more of the Albert Miller Program. You know, it's interesting when you look at, say, the last century of thought in Britain and the United States, the English-speaking world. There have been some very significant atheistic figures. I look back to the 20th century and think of people like Alfred North Whitehead and, Bertrand Russell. I mean, there was a man who knew he wasn't a believer. And then we went through a period in which it appeared there wasn't so much of the militant atheism, but they're back. Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and a host of others. Our guest today is Dr. Alvin Plantinga, professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. And we were just talking about his review of Richard Dawkins' book. But when you look at the whole question of atheism, Dr. Plantinga, what is your response to the atheist? Let's assume that we have you and Richard Dawkins in the same room, hard as that is to imagine, and you're explaining to him why belief in God is more sensical than non-belief in God. What would you say?
Of course, part of being a Christian is a result of the work of the Holy Spirit. So to some degree, faith is a gift. So I wouldn't necessarily expect to be able to argue Richard Dawkins or Daniel Dennett or Christopher Hitchens or any of these people, argue them into being a Christian or even into being a believer in God, although being a believer in God is, you might say, much more widespread across the world and more a part of our very nature, perhaps, than is being a Christian. Actually being a Christian requires God's special activity, the internal testimony of the Holy Spirit, as Calvin called it, or the internal, Thomas Aquinas had a similar term for it. But as far as belief in God goes, it seems to be the natural condition for a human being upon beholding the starry heavens above or the delicate beauty of a tiny flower. The natural thing is to think thoughts about God and think God must be great to have made all this. It seems to me it takes a special act of will in order to reject belief in God, or you have to be trained in a special way, something like that. The natural thing seems to me to be believe.
Now, when you describe this belief in terms of a properly basic belief, what do you mean?
I mean this. Since the Enlightenment, the idea, since for the last, say, 300 years, since Descartes and Locke, the idea is that in order to be responsible in believing in God, as well as in believing in most other things, you have to have evidence from other things that you know, propositional evidence. You have to be able to give some kind of argument. Or if you can't give the argument, there has to be one lurking in the background that you could give if you thought about it a little bit harder. But it seems to me that's not, my idea is that's not necessarily true at all. Lots of things are such that we believe them without ever considering any argument. It would be ridiculous to ask someone for an argument for their belief that there are other people or a past, or an external
world. Or that they had
world,
ancestors.
Or whether they had ancestors, yeah, whether there's been a past at all. I mean, Bertrand Russell once said that it could be that the world should have popped into existence just 5 minutes ago. This is a typical philosopher's fantasy, and everybody's going to laugh. It could be that a world popped into existence just 5 minutes ago, complete with all its rusty pipes and wrecked automobiles and disintegrating mountains and wrinkled faces. That could be. Well, why do you think it isn't so? You certainly don't think you need an argument for that. You just naturally think that's ridiculous. And something similar is true for belief in God, I think. You don't have to have an argument to sensibly believe in God. It just seems to be, for very many of us, it seems to be the natural thing to think, just as thinking there's a past, just as thinking there are other people.
I want to speak very candidly and tell you that one of the things I most admire about you is how you just responded to that question. in that you gave a theologically informed answer out of your own Christian conviction. And speaking of the miracle of regeneration, the internal testimony of the Holy Spirit, and recognizing that even though there is a battle of ideas, it never is merely a battle of ideas, because even as we are cognitive and rational creatures, we're never merely cognitive and rational creatures. And the great problem we face is not just the problem of ignorance and confusion, but the problem of sin. And that's just very reassuring to me to hear a Christian philosopher speak so candidly out of Christian conviction. Russ Moore, you know, why, when we look at the Evangelical Academy, do we not see more of the kind of interplay between philosophy and theology that I think we've just had in this last conversation?
I think we will in the future. I just don't think we're ready for it quite yet. But I think you have a younger generation preparing for that very kind of thing because they've had so many evangelistic encounters similar to what Professor Planning has just been talking about, in which they understand there is that act of the will. They have to respond to these objections that are being offered up. What the Apostle Paul talks about is suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. I think there's a new guard coming along who will be doing just that.
Speaking of that new guard, I want to ask Professor Plantinga, if you were speaking to parents of high school seniors right now, and they're thinking about the kind of institution to attend, would you encourage them to go to the prestigious Centers of American Learning? What would be your advice to those parents?
Well, I think it's hard to give one-size-fits-all advice. For some students, clearly the best place is a Christian college, Calvin College, Wheaton College.
And you've had experience teaching on those campuses as well.
Westmont, colleges like that. I taught at Calvin for 19 years. I think it's an absolutely marvelous institution, and I think that kind of institution is extremely important in our world. On the other hand, there are recently I was at Harvard. I was there as a student 50 years ago. At that time, there weren't any Christian organizations for students on campus at all. The closest was something in a nearby Methodist church. Now there are all kinds of Christian organizations for Oriental students, for engineering students, undergrads, graduates, science students, all different. There must be 15 different such organizations. These groups are active, and in some ways, for some students, that's a better place for that very reason. It's a bit sort of countercultural. If you're a Christian at Calvin or Wheaton, that's not countercultural. Everybody is. So is the faculty, and so on and so on. If you're one at Harvard, it is sort of countercultural. If you're the kind of person who needs to be countercultural to get along properly, well, maybe, you know, there's something to be said then for going to places like that.
Our guest today has been Professor Alvin Plantinga. He is the John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He's here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary delivering the Norton Lecture. It's one of the oldest lectureships, endowed lectureships in America, dealing with the interplay between Christianity, natural science, and philosophy. And I think one mark of his distinction is the fact that he now becomes, I believe, the first person to have delivered two different series of the Norton Lectures here at Southern Seminary, a note of our admiration for him. Professor Plantinga, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
We'll be back with final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. It was really good to have Professor Alvin Plantinga on as our guest, talking about the Christian mind, and really a wide-ranging conversation. I appreciate so many things about it. I appreciate him as an individual. I appreciate the Christian conviction that comes out as not an afterthought to his responses, but what drives his responses. Dr. Russ Moore is here with me in the studio. You know, when you listen to Professor Alvin Plantinga speak, we recognize that he's one of the most influential people in the academy worldwide today. Why aren't there more of him?
I think for so long you had Christians being marginalized in American universities and colleges, and I think right now you have some countercultural, as he mentioned, men who are coming forward and mentoring and training another generation behind them who will be doing the same thing. That's what I pray for anyway.
Now, the department there at Notre Dame, and a lot of people, I also appreciated the candor with which he spoke of that university, mm-hmm. mentioning that I think he said the majority of graduate students there are not Roman Catholic,
yeah.
but are evangelical. When you start looking at some of these intellectual centers, it's clear that that we are developing an intellectual elite for evangelicals. I'll tell you, my big concern is how we get from that to the evangelical church,
right.
where we really have to hold up a model of Christian intellectual life and thoughtfulness that really is missing from a lot of evangelical congregations.
Well, I think one piece to that is what you mentioned earlier. He's writing for Campus Crusade for Christ, training people how to integrate these things into evangelism and apologetics and discipleship at the more popular level. I think that's key. It can't simply be kept in the classrooms alone.
There's another point to this, which really comes to my mind again and again, and I think you'll agree with this, that one of the things this kind of conversation reminds us of in this day is that all of life is apologetic.
I mean,
we're having to defend everything all the time, 24/7.
And one of the helpful things he does is to remind people in our churches, we shouldn't be scared of these militant atheists. We shouldn't be scared of some of these arguments that come forward that seem so polished and intellectual and really aren't.
No, and as a matter of fact, I really appreciate the fact that he's able to speak with a very clear voice to say these guys are writing outside their field.
Right.
You know, they may know biology or, you know, from their own worldview, be able to write about biology. But when they come over and talk theology, you know, as he said, it would be called sophomoric, but that would be unfair to sophomores.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't get that kind of candor from a lot of academics.
That's right. And what we know about them that they may not know about themselves is that they have a fear of death, they know judgment is coming, and they're whistling past the graveyard.
They're trying to. And the interesting thing is even as Scripture says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. But you just have to wonder if the fool says that with as much conviction as he would have us think.
Mm-hmm.
In his comments, in his books, and when they appear on the talk shows. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. Dr. Moore is going to be your host. Meet him for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Moore Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.